This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas. Almost 6 months after the withdrawal of Australian troops from Afghanistan, it's clear the embattled country is in the midst of a major humanitarian crisis. Millions are at risk of starvation, the economy is on the verge of collapse, and a mood of despair has taken hold. Back in August last year, following 20 years of war, Australia and the US departed Afghanistan, leaving the Taliban in control. Since then, the situation has gone from bad to worse. Is Australia and the West doing enough to help struggling Afghans? What should we be doing? In this discussion, I'm talking to independent journalist, filmmaker and author Anthony Lowenstein, who's spent a lot of time in Afghanistan in the last 10 years, and Meriem Zahid, founder and director of Afghan Women on the Move. Meriem came to Australia as a refugee from Afghanistan 22 years ago. She's currently producer of My Life, My Story, a project which shares the personal stories of Afghan women living outside of Afghanistan. Stories of displacement, migration, and the effects of war. Meriem says Afghanistan is in need of urgent assistance, but Australia is not responding quickly enough.
In the past 5 months, and I'm counting every minute and every day to see if I see any results for the people, at least that I'm in contact from a community perspective and also from the families that I have there. I think the process is painfully slow. That's my observation. And there's not much real talk on how we can help them from a humanitarian perspective, if we put visa issues aside as well.
By slow, you mean slow to provide the type of assistance that's needed in Afghanistan at the moment?
As an emergency, it is a situation, yes, that immediate help and aid that needs to be either sent there or rescue them from the horrible situation that they are in.
Undoubtedly, Meriem, you're in contact with family of yours that's still in Afghanistan. What are they telling you about how bad the situation is there at the moment?
A lot of people currently are financially are struggling. There's shortage of food. There is no banks are open. There is no money coming in or going out. So they don't have much hope that people will come or international communities will come and rescue them and get them some help, or planes goes in and out of Afghanistan. So they're not much talking about come and take us and to another country. But the conversation every time we have that we are hungry, we want food, we want that shelter. So shelter and food are the main concern, because we're talking about 38 million people. And all these 38 million people are hungry, cold, and psychologically and emotionally are in a very, very difficult position.
Anthony, the conflict in Afghanistan was Australia's longest war. We are now witnessing the aftermath of it. People are, reports suggest, literally starving to death in Afghanistan at the moment. There are the most terrible reports that I've read of desperate people on the verge of having to sell their own children, sell their body parts. It is diabolical. What more should and could Australia be doing right now? And how much culpability do we have for the situation in Afghanistan today?
I think we, and I say the we, I mean the West, I think is content to punish Afghanistan for the fact that they won the war. Now, what I mean by that is many Western countries, and obviously the major player here is the US, Australia plays a role, I'll get to that in a moment. The US, of course, is the key player here after the last 20 years. The US under President Biden, and it wouldn't have been much different had it been Trump or someone else, I think is content to let the Afghan people suffer. The sanctions that are now imposed on, essentially, so they claim, the Taliban, because they don't want to recognize the Taliban as a government that is and a military militant movement that beat the US and the West over 20 years. Yes, some of them are suffering, they being the Taliban, to be sure, But the people who are principally suffering are the people, as Mariam said. There are tens and tens of millions of Afghans who are on the verge of starvation. The UN has said that roughly 98% of the population is food insecure. Now, Australia has a deep culpability there in terms of what we did in Afghanistan now is incredibly unclear. There are serious allegations of war crimes that remain unpunished. I think in general, the Australian government, both the current government and the Labor opposition, don't want to talk about Afghanistan. It's in the past. It's done. It was a debacle. Let's just move on. And the truth is, at the moment, there's no serious discussion about reparations. I mean, that's just an issue that never gets talked about. I mean, it's a foreign concept to give people reparations, those who may have suffered for harm that we as Australians caused. To me, the obvious solution here, and Australia, as I said, is a relatively minor player, of course, in the world, is recognizing and engaging the Taliban. Now, to me, doing that does not mean you embrace the Taliban, you give them a bear hug. That's not what I'm suggesting. The truth is the US is already engaging the Taliban. Let us do it covertly. And to me, at the moment, by not doing that, you are happy to allow millions of Afghans to potentially starve to death. Just finally, this does not mean by any means that I and people who advocate this position embrace the Taliban, support the Taliban. There are many governments around the world that we engage who may fundamentally be against what we believe in and support, but without a degree of engagement and discussion and financial backing, the people are the ones there who are suffering.
Yeah, Mariam, what's your take on that? This is obviously a very contested issue, how to deal with the Taliban. They're now the government of Afghanistan, whether we like it or not. And one would imagine they're also going to be responsible principally for the distribution of humanitarian assistance that comes into the country. Should we in the West recognize the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan?
To me, until we don't see Taliban given the basic human rights of every citizen in Afghanistan, I would say not to, because from the experience that I have back home and what they are saying, putting women especially aside and not recognizing their human rights and their human basic human rights, recognize them and give them the power of years and years to come to govern the Afghanistan, I would not be recommending to recognize them. But in terms of giving the people voice, people are dying, and I'm talking from being a humanitarian worker, I'm more concerned about giving the people food, give people the needs that they have. And that does not and must not be in consultation with Taliban. Taliban is just followers of their big bosses outside of Afghanistan.
Just in terms of how the local Afghan community in Australia are responding and providing their own assistance back home, are people sending money back from Australia to Afghanistan to assist their families, to assist their relatives because of the parlous economic situation there?
Yes, yes, including myself. I not only send my family my money, my families, but also I sent the community, and I sent, we run campaigns to help during the winter time. We have campaigned for many, many causes, especially in the past couple of months. But the trouble is that for how long? And for how long we can run campaigns to just send $100 a family? And for how long they have to live just on bread and water? And this is also a concern. There has to be a middle ground. There has to be a constructive approach to the needs of vulnerable communities in Afghanistan.
Anthony, what should the priority be for the government in terms of the short term, the immediate term, in providing some assistance to Afghanistan?
Well, yes. I mean, the short term is humanitarian support. And there's no doubt that there are a lot of NGOs that have been operating in Afghanistan for years who have remained there since the Taliban took over, both Australian and otherwise. They're still there. Many of them are complaining that the inability of getting funds into the country, getting enough materials into the country due to the sanctions, due, as Mariam said, the banks are almost collapsed. The infrastructure of the country is collapsing incredibly quickly. But to me, a priority of Australia should be, and this to me should be a key aim of both the federal government and the Labor opposition, is to say we as Australians have a responsibility to what has happened to this country. We occupied it for 20 years. We took in a ridiculously small number of Afghan refugees for the last 20 years. We are currently planning to take very few, if enough. I think, to put it politely, I see that the lack of speed that the Australian government has shown towards the Afghan arrivals, roughly 4,500 since August when the Taliban took over, is a deliberate aim to not be seen to be too generous to brown people before the election. That might sound incredibly brutal, but that's very much how I see it. And this, by the way, is bipartisan.
Yeah.
This is not just an attack on the Morrison government. I would say exactly the same thing if the Labor Party was in power, and they obviously may be this year, who knows. My sense is that not much would change about that. Both major sides of politics have supported the Afghan war. Neither major side of politics are talking about reparations. Neither side of politics are talking about seriously helping Afghans who have arrived in Australia. And neither side are particularly pushing for enough Afghans to help, either those in Australia now or those who could be assisted, both in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So this really has been a bipartisan failure. It's interesting to go back and look at how the vast majority of Australian politicians, and frankly, most in the media, supported the US-backed occupation for years and years, despite the fact that during that time, there were serious allegations about Afghan government war crimes, not for a second to diminish Taliban crimes, which were huge. I'm not diminishing that for a second. But there is, I think, it's a quasi-colonial mindset that says we in the West have the right to control and manage your country, Afghanistan. And even though it's been a complete disaster, when it falls apart, we will walk away. But the truth is, for years, most of the left and much of the right supported that war under the guise of we're helping Afghanistan, we're building them up, we're supporting their women. Now, having spent time in Afghanistan, there's no doubt that there are definitely groups of Afghans who benefited from the war. When I say benefited, I'm not talking about financial, though that too. Afghan women, there's no doubt huge numbers of women went to school and got educated who would never have done so had the Taliban stayed in power. That's undeniably true. But what's forgotten is that 70% of the Afghan population live in the countryside, don't live in Kabul, don't live in the cities. And many of them, including some of whom I spoke to, will say, and I'm not saying they warmly welcome the Taliban. They do not. Some might, but many do not. But for them, the last 20 years has been an absolute living hell, both from the Afghan government, from the US military forces, from drones and the Taliban. And I'm not saying they're all saying, welcome the Taliban, this is fantastic coming to our home. No, but for many of them, in many parts of the country, now is the most peaceful it's been in 40 years. That's the reality. That doesn't minimize, by the way, any of the other humanitarian crises that's going on at all. But the violence mostly has massively reduced.
No war, but economic collapse. So,
yes.
Maryam, I was reading, remarkably, half of Afghanistan's population is under the age of 18. You really have to wonder what the future is for the children in that country, don't you?
Right. And if we just focus on the absence of bombing and suicide bombs that Taliban is not doing anymore, then all we're going to have, these next generation will grow without education, without freedom of thoughts, freedoms of, without knowing about their basic human rights. Much as I agree that there has been a violence of suicide bombers and any other factors that were killing people every day, including my family members and friends that I have had in Afghanistan, I'm worried about that. If we just focus on, just because they stop suicide bombs and there's no war, the silence will kill them. Depression will kill them. Poverty will kill them. And I, women that were born 22 years ago and hoping for her future, and now she will be at home having no future, having no hope, no aspiration. So I am so worried about the future of our young Afghan boys and girls in Afghanistan.
Yes, I've heard figures of up to 100,000 people indicating that they would like to come to Australia under humanitarian visas. Anthony just spoke earlier about how slow that process is and the limited amount of humanitarian places that currently exist in Australia. But I'm wondering, are there members of your family who would like to leave?
Yes, sir. Yes, I have family members that I have also sponsored. My staff or volunteers that work for Afghan Women on the Move, still they are invisibly active, but there hasn't been any improvement or any news on what's going to happen. And that's worrying because for the past 4 months, I've lost sleep. I've been re-traumatized. Everything that has happened to me coming to Australia, with all the struggles that I came to Australia, I think that's even worse and slower than my time 22 years ago. And I'm quite disappointed to the how much we have here in Australia, how privileged we are, how much we are aware of what we have done back home and what has happened through all these international forces. Still, we are in denial of let's do something. There's a crisis.
And one imagines members of the community that you speak to here in Australia feel kind of traumatised by what they're seeing the country going through now after all those years of war. And at the end, sure, the bombs have stopped, but the place is falling apart.
Yes, because war, first of all, war takes so much from you and trauma lasts forever. So Afghan community are from a place of trauma, including myself. I've lost 20 years of my young adulthood and my childhood as well in Afghanistan. So now that everything is history is repeating itself, you can only imagine women and men also like me, how desperate and how disappointed we are that there is no platform for us to share our concerns. There is no collective approach to this crisis, and there's no outcome and impact of our talks, whether it's with our politicians or with our community members or consultation that are being taking place with Afghan community.
Anthony, I was going through some of the recent media reports in preparation for this interview, and what was striking, given the magnitude of this story and the magnitude of the suffering in Afghanistan, is how relatively little reporting there is. I mean, some media outlets, sure, have a commitment to focusing on this story, but when you compare to the focus on the withdrawal last year and the media that jumped on that and the anniversaries of the 20th anniversary reports of the war, then all of a sudden the withdrawal, and really there really is not much coverage of this given the magnitude of suffering.
I would say the media's got a really short attention span, but I think it's actually more pernicious than that. I think during the withdrawal, for sure, heaps of coverage, sympathetic coverage, coverage around the fate of the Afghan people. But you realize 6 months on how cynical that was, because many of the journalists, and I'm not just talking about here, I'm talking about the US as well, who were on the ground in Kabul reporting on friends, allies, colleagues who were trying to escape, many of those people were the ones who had spent 20 years blindly supporting the US-backed war in the first place. So for them, although they often didn't necessarily explicitly say so, some did, not all, their view was there should be an indefinite US occupation. Now, that's a view. I don't personally share that, but that's a view that one can have and agree or disagree with it, fine. But then the question is, well, what does that exactly mean? What exactly does an indefinite US occupation look like? And for many Afghans, though not all, they were so disgusted with the corruption of the current or former and current Afghan government, including some friends of mine who used to work for the government, most of whom who resigned in disgust because it was so corrupt. And I think the media in general, I would say in most of the last 20 years, with some very notable exceptions, of course, there's been some great reporting, stories, short films about the situation, true. I think in general, my feeling about journalism in general in terms of war reporting is the vast majority of journalists who report on war see themselves as embedded ideologically. I'm not just talking about embedded maybe with a US soldier or Australian soldier. That's obviously part of the game too. They're invested in the idea that there is a benign sense behind a Western-backed occupation. We are there liberating the peasants of Afghanistan. Now, it's not said as grossly as that, but I think that attitude is very much apparent. And it's not just started with Afghanistan. It was the same in parts of Iraq. It was the same in Vietnam back in the day. It's the same in parts of Libya when the West went in there in 2011. There is a constant theme of media, massive interest, then losing interest as the country collapses and falls apart. And we've seen that, I think, sadly, here in the last 6 months. And there are some journalists doing vital work still there, some Westerners and Afghans, and they're doing mostly very good work in very hard circumstances, and they should be celebrated for that. But much of the world has seemingly forgotten.
Mary-Ann, any thoughts on how we can refocus more attention on this crisis? Because I just wonder how much people in Australia, in the outer suburbs of Australia, who aren't paying close attention necessarily to everything that's going on in the news, how much they know about what's going on in Afghanistan.
Oh, and as Anthony said, that there is not much after the first couple of weeks of the crisis. There's not much has happened through social media to create the awareness. And currently I'm running an exhibition of My Life, My Story. And every single person that has came to this exhibition and are still coming, they said, we thought that everything has stopped. Everything is kind of getting either better or something, because what really happened? And that really put everything in perspective of how much people are depending on our social media presence now. Mm. A station like yourself spoke that this conversation needs to be tackled again, needs to have a very constructive approach on how we address each part of this distraction, especially now women and children that are very vulnerable part of Afghanistan's society, that they are deprived from everything that you can ask for a normal human being. And my heart cries when every time I see Afghan women, I talk with Afghan women, I even feel really guilty now that the more I speak, the more I create this hope, knowing that when I wanted to give back, my hands are not that long, because the way we live here, who will give it for me to give to them? Because I'm also coming from Afghanistan and I don't have much to give, only my voice. And my voice only can happen if we push for justice collectively.
And I think the point you made before about the role that art can play, art can cut through in a way that perhaps conventional journalism isn't cutting through.
Yeah, and My Life, My Story currently got a good attention from our friends, supporters, media as well. And I was surprised, as I said before, that how much people knew of what's happening right now after Taliban came. I think this exhibition has created to challenge the perception of Afghan community here in Australia that we can have voice, we will be asking for justice, but we need all of our Australian and multicultural communities to come and stand next to us and ask for help.
Anthony, we've spoken a lot in this discussion about the situation in Afghanistan, how the country is ruined by war and now its aftermath. But this doesn't mean that there haven't been winners out of the misery in Afghanistan. This is something I know you've looked at in the past in your film and book around disaster capitalism, making money out of misery. And you know of, don't you, private companies and private individuals who've made big money in Afghanistan. Perhaps just give us a taste of that.
You know, when the war ended, inverted commas, and the Taliban took over, people said the war was a disaster. But the question is, disaster for whom? Obviously, the Afghan people, that's a given, for many soldiers, for sure. But there are a lot of people who made a lot of money. This is some Afghan locals, but also foreigners. And I spent time in Afghanistan in the last decade, a number of times, looking at a few things. One, the private security industry, which made a killing there because the country was very insecure. And secondly, the issues around the largely untapped mineral resources under the ground. There's anywhere between $1 to $4 trillion US dollars under the ground, everything from gold, copper, lithium, some of the key resources for our technology, mobile phones, computers, etc. The short version is, in the last 20 years, the US, many other countries, including Australia, attempted to try to exploit those resources and got nowhere, is the long and the short of it. The country was at war. And now that the Taliban have taken over, there are a number of other players, namely China and Pakistan, that do hope to exploit that. You know, when the war ended, inverted commas, in August, there was a number of stories written about how America's biggest weapons manufacturers, namely Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, etc., they did unbelievably well from the war, as they did from the Iraq war. And in fact, when the Afghan war ended in August, the CEOs of those companies were saying, not even with embarrassment, we need to find new conflicts. Like, we need to find new ways to make money here, which is why I would argue, this is an aside, the war in Ukraine, or the potential war over Ukraine, is partly about that. I know that's a separate issue I won't get into, but it's partly, I think, about elements in the US pushing for some kind of conflict. But the Afghan war was a huge financial benefit for a lot more people than we like to think. And that sadly is so much what modern war is. It's about who's going to make money and who can get access to resources.
Struggling for a silver lining here, and I'm just wondering, perhaps I'm being incredibly naive by even suggesting this, but is there any hope that that mineral wealth can be tapped for the benefit of the Afghan people themselves?
I probably just will say that even if Afghanistan get benefits from all the resources that Afghanistan has, will women benefit from it? Will women get empowered by it? I always will be thinking of them that.
You know, I think with the mineral resources, and I agree with Mariam 100%, I mean, whether the country has a viable resource industry, I mean, history would suggest in countries like Afghanistan, the record's normally pretty poor, that yes, some people make some money, but most people don't make any money, particularly women who are suffering greatly, and the men, of course, too, and the kids. And there's obviously questions around whether the resources should be mined in the first place because of the risks around climate change. But look, Afghan friends of mine sort of say Afghanistan hasn't got that luxury in a way, the luxury of that conversation, that not to say one should ignore climate change, not at all, but if there are $1 to $4 trillion worth of resources, is there a way to do that sustainably? I mean, as I said, my investigation over the last 10 years in lots of countries that are similar to Afghanistan would suggest arguably not. I'm happy to be corrected on that, but I'd say the record or the chances are not that high.
Which means really the immediate way forward for Afghanistan is dependence on assistance from the countries that have helped to create the problem that they now face.
Absolutely. And that, of course, becomes an aid-dependent country, which is what it's been for the last 20 years. And that's sort of that to me is an environment that a lot of people in countries like Afghanistan don't want to be indefinitely reliant on aid. Right now, aid is vital. It needs to arrive today. But in the longer term, the idea that a country like Afghanistan is forever on the teat of the IMF or the US government or USAID, to me, is not a way for a country to thrive. And a lot of other countries like that, South Sudan and others, have been like that for years, and it doesn't work. It benefits a handful and does not really benefit the majority.
So I suppose just finally to you, Mariam, can you imagine a time in the near future when you'd be able to travel back to Afghanistan and see your friends and relatives and family there, or is that really hard to imagine right now?
It's been 27 years that I haven't, so since I've left Afghanistan. So when the Taliban came, I rang at 10:30 to my father and I said, it's all your fault because you didn't let me to go and look at now. I don't think so. Even I think for another couple of years, I don't think I would be able to go. But there's a hope and optimism in terms of us pushing for justice, bring justice. We fought before, we will fight again. Because we can't depend on when they're going to go away, so we go. We will fight for justice again.
Mariam Zahid, founder and director of Afghan Women on the Move and producer of My Life, My Story. Links to both are on the website. Before her, independent journalist, filmmaker and author Anthony Lowenstein. More information about Anthony's work can also be found on our homepage. All eyes are on the Russian-Ukraine border right now, where over 100,000 Russian troops are amassed. US President Biden has warned Russia against invading the neighbouring Eastern European country. Russian President Putin denies having such intentions. But how did it come to this? And is this a simple case of Russian aggression, or is Russia protecting its strategic interests? Former senior Australian diplomat and author of the book Return to Moscow, Tony Kevin, is currently in Moscow and he rejects the US narrative about Russian expansionism. Tony is a regular traveller to Russia and is sympathetic to their position, a view dramatically at odds with the Australian and US governments. He's in Moscow in part to deliver a lecture at the Diplomatic Academy of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, an organisation which former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has also addressed. When we spoke several days ago, no invasion had occurred. Russians in Moscow, according to Tony Kevin, have other things on their mind than the tensions between Russia and Ukraine.
I've been in Moscow now for 5 days, and I'm here for a month, and my feeling is that people are much more worried about COVID than they are about the situation in Ukraine and in relation to the West. Most Russians are inclined to trust their governments, and I think they feel that the government is handling the situation on Ukraine and in relation to the West well. But can I say something about COVID? Because I think it's pretty important. It's very much on people's minds here. Reuters put out daily statistics, and at the moment in Russia, there have been 700,000 deaths from COVID. And that's the second ranking country in the world for deaths from COVID. The top ranking is US at 911,000. So what's happening right now? New infections are skyrocketing. There's now over 171,000 new infections a day. But Russians seem to be coping with this quite well because most of them are Omicron, and there are not that many people going to hospital or dying. The death rate peaked in the end of November at nearly 3,000 deaths a day, which is huge, of course. But now the deaths have gone down to around 700 deaths a day. And Russians have learned to live with that. But it's affected daily life in all kinds of ways. So people are more subdued in the streets. There's not as much chatter and laughter as I'm used to from previous visits.
Yeah, well, that's interesting observation, because all we are hearing at the moment from Russia is obviously the story about the Ukraine and the Russian troop build-up on the border. So what are they feeling?
They feel confident that their government has sent a very strong deterrent signal. And by putting 130,000 battle-ready troops in areas around Ukraine, to the north in Belarus, to the west and to the south in Crimea, they've sent a very graphic message that they're ready to do whatever they want to do, basically, in Ukraine. And Western military planners have absorbed this message. There's no question that if Russia wanted to invade Ukraine, they could be in Kiev in 24 hours. But having sent that deterrent signal, the Russians, I think, are saying or thinking that the most important thing for them now is two things. Firstly, in relation to Ukraine, to protect the Russian-speaking people in the rebel provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk. And certainly, Russia would be ready to help those provinces respond very vigorously militarily if Ukraine tried to recapture those provinces. And they've tried twice already, and both times they've failed. The Russians, I don't think, would use an attempted invasion of those provinces by Ukraine as a pretext to take all of Ukraine. They don't really want Ukraine. They think it's a very sad country, pretty much a failed state. There's been huge emigration from Ukraine, a huge demoralization, and Nazi elements, the Ukrainian Nazi elements, have assumed positions of real power from which they can intimidate people. I think if the truth be known, most Ukrainians, more than 50%, would be very glad to be part of the Russian world again, not necessarily to lose their political independence, but to regain an ability to get on with Russia in a normal way. But the trouble is they're intimidated because very strong elements are driving the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainian government is essentially a puppet of Washington and Brussels in different ways, and it doesn't have agency.
How does Russia feel that their security interests have been infringed upon by the West that's led to this situation? Is this entirely about NATO and about the prospect of Ukraine and possibly Georgia joining NATO? Is it fundamentally what this comes down to?
It's pretty much the result of 30 years of broken promises by the West to Russia not to expand NATO. There's no doubt that in 1991, both President Reagan and his successor, President George H.W. Bush, gave firm undertakings to Russia that in exchange for allowing the reunification of Germany, which of course then Germany became the leading military power in Western Europe, NATO would not expand to the east of Germany. And those promises were repeatedly broken, first by Bill Clinton in 1996, when he invited Poland, Hungary and Czechoslovakia to join in NATO, and then by successive presidents right through to the point where now Russia is surrounded on the west by NATO countries, with the exception of Ukraine and Georgia, which NATO made very clear that they wanted to invite them in. So Russia sees a string of Western military threats in very close proximity to its main population heartland, which is European Russia. The Ukrainian border is only 500 kilometers from Moscow. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, very small states, but they still are repositories for NATO military power. And Russians are angry about this and they're fearful about it. And they are determined in the last few months to put an end to this, to try to demilitarize the adjacent countries near their borders and to try to create a better security climate for all of Europe through having a demilitarized zone to their west. Now, the America and NATO have rejected this out of hand. They have said that every European country has sovereignty and they have sovereignty to choose who they align with and which countries they choose to have military exercises with. For America, that's the end of the story. For Russia, it is not the end of the story. For Russia, it's an unacceptable situation.
And as far as the West and America is concerned, further to that, they express the view that Russia has expansionist intentions in Eastern Europe, that the troop build-up on the border is a sign of blatant intimidation to the Ukrainians, and as you say, that Ukraine is perfectly entitled, if they wish, to join NATO.
Well, it's not a view that Russia feels comfortable with, and the best metaphor, of course, is by analogy. Would America feel comfortable if Canada and Mexico did what the Americans and the NATO view is that the countries adjacent to Russia should be doing? I'm sure that's not true. In fact, America even has a thing called the Munro Doctrine that it says that, and Biden just recently reasserted it, that all of Latin America is its, quote, front yard, unquote, and that America will not tolerate any challenge to its sphere of influence effectively in Latin America. So what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, most Russians would feel. And they would say, well, it's not unreasonable to say that these little countries to our west should come to a sensible, peaceful accommodation with Russia in order that normal economic relations can resume. These are all broken countries. I mean, Ukraine is a failed state. The emigration from Ukraine over the last decades has been enormous. It's been virtually depopulated of its young, skilled people. They've fled as emigrants to Europe and also to Russia, according to their choices. Ukraine's a corrupt little place run by oligarchs. It's a reservoir of cheap labour for the European community. I think there are hopes in the European community that Ukraine will replace China as a low-cost source of cheap labour and cheap factory locations, so that you can have a white Christian community of basically underpaid labour to the east of Europe. So that's the European strategic vision. The American strategic vision is that, basically the militarization of Ukraine, that it's obviously geographically advantageous to have a highly militarized country, even if it's a broken state, to Russia's west and south.
So what sense do you get about the effect of Putin's meeting with the French President Macron? Has it had any positive impact, do you think? I mean, Macron made the statement, there is no security for Europeans if there is no security for Russia, which apparently got some people worked up. Any sense at the moment that that meeting has been a circuit breaker?
Yes, I think it has in important ways. And Putin has already said that he regards Macron as a serious interlocutor, unlike the Americans and the NATO chief, Stoltenberg, who really only know how to basically lay down ultimatums and affirm their positions. They don't know how to negotiate, whereas Macron is a very skilled negotiator, and he's looking for ways forward with Russia. And somehow or other, he's trying to create space for some normalization of the Ukrainian situation, and they're going on talking. Now, of course, Macron has to face great suspicion from the Americans and from NATO that he's letting down the Western side. So he has to tread very carefully.
How much of the West's attitude toward Russia can be explained by Russia's closer ties with China? Is this part of a bigger geopolitical set of alignments? And is Australia, for example, treating Russia as a proxy for China, with whom obviously our relations have badly soured?
With respect, I don't see that as the issue. I think Russia has moved towards China very much in reaction to the Western hostility towards Russia. And let me bring this element in, because it's an essential element in the way I see things. The West has become imprisoned in its own false narrative about Russia. And this false narrative goes back a very long time indeed. In my book, Return to Moscow, I talk about it quite a bit. The West has always seen Russia as too big and too threatening. And the West has always wanted to preserve its own global hegemony, its colonial hegemony, by keeping Russia down. I argued in my lecture in Moscow yesterday that the most important strategic alliance for Australia today is Five Eyes, which started as an intelligence sharing community and has now become essentially a strategic policy community comprising US as leader, UK as deputy, Canada, Australia, and the fifth eye, New Zealand, has fallen away. We are in this narrative, and it's become so pervasive and so powerful that it's very hard for people like me to ask people to consider other alternative possibilities, other alternative ways of looking at the world. And so we have this way of looking at Russia as a sort of a predator waiting to pounce.
Is that a hangover from the Cold War, do you think?
Yes, it is. Russians believe they themselves decided to abandon communism, the experiment that failed, and to move forward with democracy. And at that point, Russia wanted to be friendly with the West and wanted to be open to the West. Unfortunately, the West was caught in its own inertia of the Cold War, and they couldn't resist basically trying to weaken Russia even after the end of communism. And so you had these agencies in Russia who were basically trying to turn the economy upside down, demoralize the people, lose faith in themselves. Russia went through terrible years from 1985 to 2000. They call them the second time of troubles. The first one was after Ivan the Terrible died. And the memory of those years and how Putin came in 2000 and helped put Russia back on its feet and restore its self-confidence and its self-respect, these are very strong memories. It's very hard for people in the West to understand that there is this alternative narrative.
Tony, you're a friend of Russia. You've travelled there, I think, four times in the last 6 years. Tell us about why you keep returning, what you love about the place and the people there, and I suppose more broadly, tell us a bit about your interest in Russia, which goes back, I should say, your connections to Russia, to the late 60s and early 70s, when I think it was one of your first diplomatic postings, back in the days when you were a diplomat.
Yes, Russia was my very first diplomatic posting at the height of the Cold War from 1969 to 71. It was a very paradoxical time because I was, of course, loyal to my side, and we lived in a bubble in Moscow. We felt we were surrounded by the enemy, and we had to watch our security above all. But we still managed to find ways of learning to appreciate some of the good things Russia had to offer, which even then, in the grey old days of Brezhnev communism, were wonderful. I mean, the music, the theatre, the restaurants, the skiing, the walks in the country in summer, a wonderful place. And I came through Russian music and literature and art, of course, wonderful museums then too, to really appreciate that Russia is one of the great world civilizations. And I sort of put that knowledge aside for the rest of my career. I went on to have another 25 years in foreign affairs, finishing up as ambassador to Poland and then to Cambodia. But after I retired, I managed to start thinking outside the square again, if you like. I was no longer bound by the official narrative that I'd obviously been bound by when I was working as an Australian diplomat. And more over the years, I came to realize that Russia was a country that was much maligned, much misunderstood, and hard done by. And so when I went on my first trip to Russia in 2016 as an individual citizen, I was ready to look at the country with an open mind. I've more and more come to admire Russians and the way they live and the way they function. They've had this incredible trauma of World War II, and they saved the world in World War II from Nazism. Mm. There's no question. If it hadn't been for the Russian sacrifice of 26 million people over a four-year brutal war, we would not be where we are today. We might all be speaking German and waving Nazi flags. Who knows?
You have been very fortunate to find yourself in positions at historic moments of time. I mean, as I said, posted to Moscow as a young diplomat in the late 60s, early 70s, but perhaps even more significantly than that, you returned to Eastern Europe as ambassador to Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia just after the Iron Curtain comes down and the Soviet Union collapses from 91 to 94. So you're in that part of the world when the Soviet Union dissolves and the Russian Federation is established. Just tell us a bit about your memories from that time and perhaps what you learnt, if anything, from that period.
I was in Poland in my first year when the attempted coup against Gorbachev took place, when there was a very strong attempt to wind the clock back, to bring back the old communist regime that Gorbachev was trying to change. It failed, which was the end of Gorbachev, and it was the opportunity for Yeltsin to take control. And so all that happened while I was in Warsaw, which was, as you say, an incredibly good vantage point.
So you're in Moscow at the moment. You, I think last night, delivered a lecture at the Diplomatic Academy of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation. This is an institution, I should say, that Kevin Rudd has also addressed. Just give us an idea of what you spoke about in your talk last night.
First of all, I found out last night that since Kevin Rudd, there's been one other Australian visitor speaker there, and that is Hugh White. So they were pretty interested in what Hugh White had to say. I started off by talking about the similarities between Russia and Australia, and these are very profound similarities, which we in Australia and possibly people in Russia are not necessarily aware of. So I spoke about similarities of geography, of demography, that we're both outliers of both Europe and of Asia, that we both have a complex colonial and imperial, in Russia's case, in our case colonial, and multicultural history, that we've both relied on skilled immigration and capital-rich immigration to enhance and enrich and deepen and diversify our countries, that we've both shared radical democratic histories. Russians admire the way Australia was a pioneer of feminism, of trade unionism, of universal suffrage. And of course, there were the strong Communist Party links during the communist period. And finally, that we both have a tendency outside small dissident groups to trust in the integrity of our governments. And this can both be a good thing or a bad thing. I believe that in Russia's case at the moment, it's a good thing because Russia is under attack from ruthless enemies from the West who really want to bring the country and its system down by every possible means. So it's a good thing that the dissidence in Russia is very small and very contained. In my country, Australia, I think it's the reverse. It's unfortunate that so many people unthinkingly trust our government's narrative and don't critically examine it, because we're not under any threat. And we have an opportunity to move to a much more rational foreign policy in which we don't divide the world into friends and enemies, but we rely on the United Nations collective security system, the Security Council, and we cultivate good relations with our neighbours and with our region. So a friend to all and an enemy to none. And I think it's interesting that some of Australia's leading political figures, not only Gough Whitlam, but Malcolm Fraser, followed by Paul Keating and followed by Bob Carr in New South Wales, have in retirement come to see the world pretty much as I see it now. But somehow or other, when people are trapped in their jobs, even prime ministers, the narrative prevails. Australia really needs to find its home in Asia. Our home is not in Europe. Our home is not in England. England is the motherland for some of us, but it's not the motherland for many of us. And one of my points in my lecture was to say that there's this paradox at the moment that Australia is a multicultural country of rich diversity, but it's ruled by a pale, male, stale Anglo-Celtic elite. And we have to somehow break the bonds of the American alliance. I don't mean we have to become an American enemy, of course not, but we have to learn to stand on our own feet. I made the assertion very bluntly in my lecture last night that since 1996, Australia has lost its sovereignty. So whether we can recapture it after a change of government, it will take a very long time, because we're very locked in now to seeing the world the way Washington elite sees it. And I'm saying this not as an opponent of America. I mean, at the level of people, I love the Americans and I love the British. But unfortunately, the elites in those countries have taken Australia down a very dangerous path. We are a top-rank nuclear target if there should ever be the disaster of nuclear war between Russia and the West, or between China and the West, although we threaten nobody. And so there are big changes, I hope, coming in Australian political discussion. And what I bring to that discussion, my particular edge, is, I suppose, my knowledge of Russia and my love and respect for Russia, which is pretty rare in Australia these days. There aren't too many people out there who are openly expressing the sorts of views that I express.
And is there much interest in Russia toward Australia? I know in your talk you said that you believe Russia should take the longer view of the potential for rewarding dialogue and closer relations with Australia, but I just wonder, are we even on the radar as far as Russia is concerned and Russians are concerned?
It's a very good question. We're certainly not high on the radar, but Australia is certainly a second-rank diplomatic interest for them at this time, simply because we are so subservient to the United States' view of the world. We will become more interesting to them if we show some signs of foreign policy independence, because, as I was talking about our similarities, we both have a huge amount potentially to offer each other. We both are on the periphery of this great new Asian economic heartland of the world. We share our affinities to the West and our affinities to the East. We can talk to each other very usefully about these things, but we have to take the first step of cutting the umbilical cord, of not just expecting all insights and wisdom to come from Washington.
Former senior Australian diplomat and author of the book Return to Moscow, Tony Kevin. More details about Tony and our earlier speakers are available on the Big Ideas homepage. That's it for today. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Until next time, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.